From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Acclaimed Southwest Florida artist Iki Matsumoto died this month at the age of 79. His silk screens depicting the wildlife and subtropical landscapes of our region garnered international attention. Matsumoto, along with his wife Polly, ran a gallery on Sanibel Island. Ahead of his memorial service early next month, we'll listen back to our 2010 interview with Matsumoto about his life, work, and the role the arts play in diversifying Florida's economy. Plus, we'll take a closer look at the costly but vital work of beach nourishment. The practice of bringing in additional sand to combat the effects of wave erosion is a regular practice on beaches all along the Gulf Coast here in Southwest Florida. We'll explore what goes into the practice and what it means for property owners, beachgoers, wildlife, and our area's tourism-driven economies. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. For the rest of the hour, we'll be exploring the value of Florida's beaches and the practice of renourishing them. With an estimated 810 million day visits to Florida beaches each year, the Sunshine State's idyllic beaches are believed to be the most visited in the world, according to a recent analysis by James Houston of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Engineer Research and Development Center. Maintaining those beaches by fighting the effects of wave erosion is vital to the tourism-driven economies of coastal regions, and they can serve as a first line of defense against damage from coastal disasters. But beach renourishment projects can also be very costly. Projects have recently been completed or are underway throughout Southwest Florida, including Naples, Marco Island, Bonita Beach, Estero Island, Sanibel and Captiva Islands, and now Anna Maria Island, just to name a few. Joining me now for a closer look at the practice of beach nourishment is Kate Gooderham. She's co-executive director of the American Shore and Beach Preservation Association, as well as president of the Fort Myers-based consulting firm Gooderham & Associates. She also serves as a member of the Lee County Coastal Advisory Council and is vice chair of the Lee County Disaster Advisory Council. Kate Gooderham, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. And also joining us by phone today is senior scientist with the Woods Hole Group, Dr. Lee Wisher. Woods Hole Group is an international environmental, scientific, and engineering consulting organization based out of Massachusetts. Wisher has more than 3 decades' experience in coastal engineering, environmental impact assessment, ecological restoration, and sediment transport. Dr. Wisher, thanks for your time this morning as well.
Thank you for having us.
And I invite our listeners to join the conversation. If you have a question or comment for our guests, phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. That's 1-877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or comment on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And first of all, Kate, how pervasive are beach renourishment efforts here in Southwest Florida? We just mentioned a few recent projects going on locally, but is this pretty much an ongoing effort here?
It's a huge effort. In fact, it would be easier for me to list the beaches that haven't been restored in our area
right.
than it would be to list the ones that have. It's been a tremendous effort, and recently, we have Naples, Captiva, and the northern Sanibel area, Gasparilla Island. And now a little further north, we have Anna Maria that is in the midst of their project. But those are ones that have just been restored in the last few months. It's been a tremendous effort.
And we know this practice of adding sand to a beach is done to maintain or widen it. But can beach renourishment actually prevent future erosion?
I can answer that.
Sure.
The answer is it doesn't prevent future erosion. Beaches are going to naturally erode due to the incident, waves and currents. But what beach nourishment does is it restores the beach, pushes the high water line offshore, and then helps protect the upland that's behind the beach.
Okay. And how often does beach renourishment need to be repeated? And does that really kind of depend on the location? And I'm sort of thinking about renourished beaches maybe lasting longer here along the Gulf Coast, where the wave action is a bit calmer compared to our counterparts on the east coast of Florida, where you've got stronger waves coming in from the Atlantic.
Well, that's a really good question, and it really the size of the project really depends on the processes that you just talked about. The incident waves how frequent the storms are, how large the storms are. So a beach nourishment project on the Atlantic coast would be much larger because of the fact that when we do a beach nourishment project, we have an engineered beach, basically. The beach height, its width, and the height of the dunes behind are designed to withstand certain frequency of storms. And so one of the things that actually happens is that when you do a beach nourishment project, often there are some trade-offs that are done in the, or actually occur in the engineering design. You may design a beach to withstand a 100-year storm, or you may design it to withstand a 50-year storm or a 25-year storm. And so if you design a beach to withstand a 25-year storm and you have a 100-year storm, then the beach is, you know, the beach nourishment is going to provide protection, but at the end of the storm, it's likely to be pretty much depleted. And so really, it's managing your expectations. And when the beach is designed, you need to understand exactly how it's designed.
Okay, understood. And Kate, you know, since you're here in Fort Myers along with us most of the year, I know you're probably much more in tune with projects going on around here. But, you know, barring some of these big storms that we've talked about, how long do beach renourishment projects typically last? How often do they need to be repeated around our area?
Well, yesterday I was speaking with the project manager for the Anna Maria project, and their interval is 10 years. And I think the Captiva project interval is 7 years. So that it's usually 7 to 10 years, and it's designed for a certain life, and it's used, and I think Lee could talk more about it, but it's based on an optimum. What's going to be the most cost-effective time, length, everything that they take into consideration. That, you know, they could design a beach to last much longer than 7 or 10 years, but is that the most cost-effective thing to do? And so 7 to 10 seems to be the norm in Florida.
Okay. And, you know, as we've talked about, or as I mentioned earlier, this process can be extremely expensive. You know, there's one project going on right now for Lido Beach, estimated to cost some $22.7 million. But, you know, given all the benefits that we'll get into later in the conversation, do we still see a net gain, do you think?
Well, I think absolutely. And the fact that if you look at some of the dollar figures that are generated by the beaches in Florida, the return on investment is huge. I mean, for instance, tourism, beachgoers in 2012 spent about $36 billion on Florida, you know, in the Florida area and in the coastal counties, and they accounted for over 500,000 jobs. So, you know, the impact to the local economies is absolutely huge. And so the amount of money that is taken in, it can be has been estimated to be the return on investment is anywhere between 8 to 300 times dollar for dollar of what's spent on the beach nourishment.
It really is the best, one of the best investments you can possibly make.
And I'm just wondering about when considering whether or not to renourish a stretch of beach that we see is eroding, what factors need to be taken into account? Basically, are there conditions under which we should recommend not renourishing a beach?
Well, in some cases, that is actually what occurs because of mainly due to regulatory considerations. If you have rocky reefs that are offshore or other habitat that has endangered species, sometimes the decision is to allow the beach to erode and then put in seawalls or revetments. But, you know, that has a cost, too, because of the fact that you're trading one environment for another, and so it becomes a very difficult decision. But other than for environmental reasons where you have, you know, some kind of a fixed resource that you need that might be impacted, there are very few areas that I would think that we would not consider for renourishment.
And as kind of a general rule of thumb, would we consider beaches that are not developed, like I'm thinking maybe something more along the lines of Lover's Key compared to a little further north on Estero Island where there is all that development, just, I guess, more natural beaches where we don't have as much human development, are those less likely to be renourished than ones where go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Actually, Lover's Key has been renourished several times.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is one of our renourished beaches, and the thing, we don't think of it as being developed because there aren't condominiums on it or hotels, but what we forget is there is a state park.
Right.
And that is a huge resource and a huge benefit to the people of Florida, to the, you know, thousands, if not more than that, people who visit that park every year. To lose that facility would be a huge loss to both the people of Florida and the people, really, of the United States and the rest of the world who love to visit that park.
And I would like to add to that is that other than just the human factor, restoring the beaches restores vital habitat in some areas. Restoring beaches in preserved areas that do not have a lot of human interaction, where the beaches become depleted and you're losing that particular resources, it's because it sometimes is vitally important for nesting birds, for migrating birds, for turtles, and so habitat restoration is also a vital component of beach nourishment.
And I guess we also should talk about the barrier and barrier islands. You know, when you talk about the barrier and barrier islands, we're talking about they are protecting another landmass. And so you lose that barrier island, you are leaving the land behind it unprotected.
Right. So just to, you know, in addition to providing that sort of first line of defense against coastal disasters or storms, could this also be a boon for, you know, residents who own property along the coastline? Can, you know, the conditions of the beaches impact their I guess, risk assessment and what they might pay for something like flood insurance premiums?
Absolutely. In the fact that FEMA does recognize engineered beaches and takes that into account for figuring flood insurance rates. And so if you have an engineered beach in front of your property and demonstrate that to FEMA, you do get a reduction in flood insurance rates. And that's because FEMA understands that an engineered beach reduces the potential for upland damage and flooding, at least from the beach side.
We're taking a closer look at the practice of beach renourishment projects with Kate Gooderham of the American Shore and Beach Preservation Association, as well as Lee Wisher with the environmental and engineering consulting firm Woodhull Group. Join the conversation with your comments and questions. Phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK, or send email to golfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And I had read that renourished beaches tend to erode away faster than the natural sand that's on the beach. Why is that?
Well, in some cases, that's true. So when you renourish a beach, matching the grain size becomes very important. And in some cases, it's very difficult to do that. And so oftentimes, the grain size is slightly smaller. And so if you put a beach nourishment project up that has a slightly smaller grain size, then it will erode a little bit faster. However, that's taken into the design also, and so the way it's, in kind of layman's terms, the way it's compensated for is you put a little bit more sand on the beach during the renourishment project to make up for that. But if the project is constructed with a beach-compatible sand, then it will normally erode at the same frequency or same rate as the normal beach.
Could I add something too, Lee? And Lee may need to help me explain it a little better, but when a sand is put on the beach, it is because it's constructed by human beings with bulldozers, it's not put on, the beach is not sloped, it's kind of drops off.
Right.
And we let the waves do the last part of the work, and have the waves actually give more slope to the beach. And some of that is seen as erosion, but actually it isn't. It's part of the process of reshaping the beach into its natural configuration. Do I need a little help there, Lee?
Well, Kate, you've captured most of it. So there's two basic ways to construct a beach nourishment project. One is through hydraulic dredging, of which the sand is placed up onto the beach by hydraulic dredge. So basically you're pumping a slurry of sand and water onto the beach. And so as that beach builds, as the water basically decants offshore and diffuses through the beach becomes more compacted. And that beach is a little bit more resistant to the initial reshaping that happens to waves. So basically an equilibrium is being established by the new beach. And when you put sand up on the beach using dump trucks and bulldozers, that compaction doesn't happen as readily. And so the beach, just as Kate said, is more, reaches equilibrium much quicker, and that's just a redistribution of sand. And so, again, as Kate said, is there's appearance of erosion, but really it's just the equilibrium slope that's being reestablished.
So basically with all the human effort that goes in, Mother Nature still has to take that last step in the process.
Absolutely. You can't fool Mother Nature.
And we talked about, you know, how renourished beaches can be a boon for wildlife, but I'm wondering about when the projects are actually going on, what kind of steps are taken to minimize impacts? Do we have, for instance, regulations that keep these projects from going on during sea turtle nesting season?
Absolutely. So there are time of year restrictions for various wildlife, especially here in Florida. And so when you're doing a beach nourishment project, then typically it cannot be done during turtle nesting season because of the fact that they're concerned about that. And offshore, when the project is being done, there are also steps that are taken to help prevent wildlife takes from the hydraulic dredge if that's the mechanism that you're using to, or equipment you're using to put sand up on the beach.
And I'm wondering about instances where, you know, sand is taken from offshore for a renourishment project. You know, what steps are taken to minimize any potential harmful impact on marine life? Or even in terms of a recently renourished beach, could there be negative impacts for organisms living in that near shore marine environment?
Well, that's two very good questions, and there's two separate ones. For instance, a lot of the dredges are required to use turtle exclusion devices now to make sure that they do not impact turtles. And I believe turtles are the biggest potential impact on the during the dredging process. Up on the beach, you have to remember that, you know, the beach is a very dynamic environment, and so large animals such as sea turtles, you know, we manage those by time of year restrictions. A few years ago, there was a lot of concern about the little microfauna that lives in the beaches, copepods and other little animals that the shorebirds feed on. And so studies have been done and show that those animals repopulate extremely quickly because of the fact that they live in a dynamic environment. And so when a storm comes up, it's not uncommon that those, just naturally, those populations go up and down, and they reproduce very quickly just because of the fact they have to be able to survive in that environment. So the short answer is there are steps that are taken, and most times, I'd say 99% of the times, there's very little impact to the flora and fauna.
I think you and your listeners would be just amazed at the amount of research and scientific study that has gone into this entire process in terms of looking at the burrow areas and how it responds, and looking at the nearshore environments, and looking at the pipeline areas and how the dredges react, and just really all the components of this have really been studied and are highly regulated in order to make this process as a win-win situation all the way around. And in some cases, just the work in the borrow area actually stirs up nutrients and gets some nutrients out back into the system that weren't there before, and so fish populations appreciate that. So it's a complicated process.
Understood. Let's take a phone call now from Rod in Port Charlotte. Rod, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Yeah, hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Did you have a comment or question for our guest this morning?
I sure do. You know, myself and many, many, many other Florida residents really enjoy looking at the beach being renourished. But I have to tell you, I'm always aghast at what they're charging for it. Now, you're talking to two interest groups who have a vested interest in continuing operations as normal and paying hundreds of millions of dollars payable to the American taxpayer to renourish a beach, pointing to all the tax dollars that they're going to make from tourism. I like the idea of Burns Beach renourishment. I do. I don't like the price. I really don't. You know, there are cement breakwater systems that are designed to help maintain and support the existing beach so that it doesn't erode. Now, I do know a little bit about the movement of sand and water and how it takes from one area and gives to another. It's the nature of a beach. And I do know that if you put a cement breakwater system outside the breaker to build the beach, it will erode in one area to give to another. However, so does the water. So does the current. And if you created a cement breakwater system off the beach, you would maintain the existing beach. And when the hurricane comes in, it wouldn't take as much out of the beach when the hurricanes come. And it wouldn't cost so much to maintain. On the other side of the state, on the East Coast, the counties actually buy their own equipment. They hire their own men and they keep them on board. And it doesn't cost way as much as what's happening here on the West Coast. The West Coast, nobody wants to hire anybody. The counties don't want to hire anybody. They don't want to maintain the equipment. So they'd rather go out and pay much more than what they have to maintain that beach. Hey, you remember, any profit that is made from what the county has to pay is more money outside of the taxpayer's wallet. Because the difference of what they're charging and what it costs is profit, and that's the difference that we could be saving. And that's what I have to say.
Thanks so much for your call, Rod, and we'll ask you to listen to the response on the air. Did you want to respond to Rod's concerns?
Sure. I think there's a couple of very good points that your caller made. The first is that, yes, there are many systems of which can be put offshore to slow beach erosion. However, in the regulatory environment that we have, in many cases that's just not possible. But the one point I would like to emphasize that actually your caller made is that when you put a structure offshore and you have you interrupt the littoral flow, or basically the flow of sand and water along the beach, yes, you will stop or drastically slow down the movement of sand, and so basically what you will do is then you will create a hotspot down at the end of your offshore structure, of which will have to be managed. And so basically you can think of it's like maintaining a checking account. It's a budget. There's so much money coming in and so much money going out. In this particular case, it's sand. And so if you stop the sand from moving through the system, you know, Mother Nature is going to make up that deficit downdrift of the structure. Mm-hmm. And so therefore you're just translating one problem down further down the beach. Some offshore structures are put in to manage, again, what we call hotspot erosion areas. But in general, it's just not possible to permit and or maintain large offshore structures on the scale that he was talking about. As for the cost, everybody agrees that, you know, the state of Florida spends a lot of money on beach nourishment, absolutely. But there's a couple little facts that I think need to be kept in perspective. One is that, you know, the beach tourists paid $2.2 billion in state sales taxes last year, in 2012, and that was about 12% of all the taxes paid within the state of Florida. And that also translated to $1 billion in local taxes, and also $3.2 billion in federal taxes. And so the beaches are big business for the state of Florida. And I think they're a vital component to the tourism, to the economy. And anything that can be done to increase the life of structures should be considered. And in many cases, the state was very down on what we call low-profile groins, and which is basically a groin is a shore normal structure which is put out to trap sand. And so in certain areas, those are being considered, again, to slow down the amount of sand that's moving through. So this kind of goes to your directly to the comment that your caller had, is that, yes, there are things that can be done to slow down the movement of sand, to slow the erosion of the beach, and to lengthen the life expectancy of the beach nourishment project, and therefore the life cycle cost of the project would be reduced.
And I wanted to touch again on this issue of hydraulic dredging, not on the process itself, but rather where the sand comes from. Later this month, Sarasota County commissioners will be discussing a proposed beach renourishment project that dredges sand in Sarasota Pass to be used for a nourishment project addressing the eroding beaches on Lido Key or Lido Key. And that has some residents concerned about how taking sand from the sandbar near Siesta Key could impact wave action hitting the beaches there. Is that something that beach renourishment projects need to take into account? How where they're getting the sand from could impact a beach somewhere else?
It absolutely. As a matter of fact, about 20 years ago, very little consideration was given to what the impact of the borrowed sites had on the beaches. And so what we found is in going back and studying old borrow sites offshore, is that in some cases the borrow sites were large enough and positioned in such a way that they actually focused wave energy on shore and created what we call erosional hotspots. Now, the science of beach nourishment and the science of being able to predict the effects of borrow sites is fairly sophisticated. And so those are effects that are routinely taken into account when designing a beach nourishment project. And so should that be a concern? Absolutely. Is it something that should be studied? Absolutely. And once you understand what the borrow site is and what its impacts are, then you can make decisions on whether or not the project should be either redesigned or you should find a new borrow site. And I might add rather quickly is that the reason the shoals are very attractive as a sand source is because they're renewable. So as the sand moves down the shore and it interacts with the tidal inlet, basically the water coming out of the inlet, the tidal flows on the ebb flow, push the sand offshore into deeper water, and there it deposits out. And so this is a renewable resource that if you take sand from the ebb tidal shoal over a period of time, that sand will be redeposited just through natural processes. And so that's one of the reasons it's a very attractive source. But again, you need to understand the processes and make sure you don't have any downdrift effects.
Now, in this hydraulic dredging, would you say that the typical way that sand is recovered and put back on the beach, or and I only mention it because I know the project recently completed in Naples involves a little bit of inter-county controversy, not about the project itself, but about the route trucks were taking from some inland site to carry the sand. So what kind of considerations go into effect when we're looking at things like grain size? Is it really important to get as close to a match as possible to the sand that's naturally there?
Well, that's, I think, two questions. One is
the, I'm sorry, I've been doing that to you this morning.
That's okay. And I think I did address the grain size. It is important to get as close as possible because of the fact that it affects the design and how much sand is going to be put on the beach. And there are limits about how much finer the sand can be and still make a viable project. As for the truck haul issue, I think Kate can, she was involved in part of that, and I think she could answer that.
Decisions on how you are going to, really this whole, a great deal of this process is has to do with cost benefit, and what is the most cost effective way of getting sand on your beach. And in the case of Collier County, within the restrictions that they had, it was the least expensive method of for them to get sand on the beach was to do a truck haul project. And so that decision was made.
Right, right. And I don't want to get too much more into that controversy because that really had nothing to do with the project itself. But I also wanted to ask about sea level rise and that impact. And where do, you know, nourishment projects come into play in consideration of sea level rise?
Well, sea level is rising at a couple millimeters per year, and the rates are still being determined. But, I mean, to put it in perspective, if you put one or two nickels on top of each other, that's basically the rate that the sea level is rising on, you know, each year. And again, that there are different rates for different areas of the country. But your question is very good because of the fact that sea level rise is on the order of very small on an annual basis. Beach nourishment projects are a very good first line of defense against sea level rise because of the fact that they put sand in the system and the increase in water level has very little effect on the beach nourishment project itself. And so it would really take decades for the sea level rise to have some impact on a beach nourishment project. And because of the fact that typical project is on the order of, you know, is 7 to 10 years, as Kate pointed out, that those projects are being renourished on a regular frequent basis. And, you know, each time they get renourished, you know, the design engineer will go back and look at the conditions to make sure the design is appropriate and that it can be redesigned to take into any accounts of sea level rise.
And Kate Gooderham, I know one of your major projects with the American Shore and Beach Preservation Association is organizing and executing conferences. The organization's 2014 Coastal Summit is coming up in February in D.C. Tell us about the summit.
Well, the ASBPA puts on two conferences a year, one that's policy-oriented and one that's more technical. And the Coastal Summit is the 25th through 27th of February in Washington, D.C., and it is policy-oriented. And that is where we get our membership to come to D.C. to meet with their members of Congress and the various agencies that deal with the coast, as well as to learn more about the process, the political process, and have really an opportunity to meet with the people who make decisions and who are a significant part of projects. And I know Lee will cringe when I say this, but the science and the engineering for doing these projects is a pretty straightforward thing. The policy aspects are very complicated in terms of learning how to best maneuver through that kind of quagmire.
Right. Well, that is all the time we have for today's show, but I want to thank my guests. Kate Gooderham is co-executive director of the American Shore and Beach Preservation Association and president of the consulting firm Gooderham & Associates here in Fort Myers. Kate, so good to talk with you today.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Also, thanks to Dr. Lee Wisher, senior scientist with the Woods Hole Group, an international environmental, scientific, and engineering consulting group. Thanks for your time this morning as well.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be on.
And there's more information on today's show, as well as an archive of past shows on our website, wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to Amy Tardiff and my producers Luke Martin and Richard Chinqui. This is WGCU, Fort Myers, 90.1 FM, WMKO Marco, 91.7 FM.